from Saratoga.
Hi, Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I'm going to have to use the mic, I guess, because I have a little bit of a cold. But, yeah. But it's good to be here. Camille asked me if I would be a 10-minute speaker tonight, since I celebrated my fourth birthday this year, or this month, so. Thank you. When I first came in, though, I didn't come into AA right away. What I did was I stopped drinking. I stopped drinking for about 6 months. I knew I had a drinking problem, and I didn't really know anything about AA. And I had a good friend of mine, a priest friend of mine, who I used to drink with a lot, tell me that I should come to AA. And I just thought that AA was for people that couldn't stop drinking. And I had stopped drinking, so I didn't think I needed to come. But as as he shared with me a little bit about AA, it really sounded very attractive, and it sounded like something that I should get involved with, because it was a program, as he described, of living. And it would help me with the living problems that I was having in my life. Because even though I had stopped drinking, I still had a lot of problems. I still had a lot of difficulty relating with people. I had problems being honest with myself and with other people. I had just a lot of problems getting to work. I could never get to work on time. I had problems with money. I had problems with being depressed, being lonely, and all of these kinds of things. And he told me that one of the main things that he had gotten out of AA was the support. And that was something that I definitely needed in my life, because I felt very lonely a lot of times and isolated, especially since most of my friends were still drinking pretty heartily. And I had to find new friends and people that I could relate to sober. So I thought I'd give AA a shot, and I came. And I came, I think, mainly because I saw something different in him. We were really good drinking buddies. I was in the seminary, and he was my confessor. And we drank a lot together. We'd drink every Friday, Saturday night. We'd just sit in his room, and we would start drinking around 3 or 4 for cocktails, and then we'd go out to dinner, and usually we always, we had dinner, but, I think we probably never ate maybe a bite full of the dinner. We'd end up coming back home and sitting in his room till 1 or 2 in the morning and just drinking. And he stopped drinking, and I thought it was good, because I thought he was starting to have a problem with it. And I remember even calling the counseling people, Valley Med, and setting up an appointment for him, because I was really getting very worried for him. He was having blackouts, he had a car wreck, and all of these different kinds of things. He was having all kinds of problems, so I'd been the good kind of just try to get him in to see somebody to talk about his problem. And he stopped drinking, and he never told me why. He never told me because he was an alcoholic. He just said that he stopped drinking because he had a problem with his liver. So, I just said, oh, okay. He said he had a staph infection or something, and that the doctor had advised him that he better stop drinking, and he was on this real strict diet, and he couldn't eat any fats and all this kind of stuff. So I just went along with it. I didn't know any better. And I remember a couple of months later, we were going out to San Francisco for dinner, and we went out to dinner, and I ordered some wine, and he wasn't drinking. And he goes, he always told me, go ahead and order whatever you want. I'm not drinking, but don't let that distract you. So I ordered some wine, and it suddenly struck me that I had a problem, because the only reason I ever drank wine was because he liked wine, and I never liked wine. I remember I never liked the taste of wine, and here I was ordering this wine, and it was just impulsive. It was just kind of an instinct. I just ordered it, and then I got it sitting in front of me, and I was drinking it down. I thought, gee, I don't like wine, and I thought, but I really need this glass of wine. It hit me right there. I really need it, because I've had a rough week, and I deserve to relax. And so I was drinking this wine, and the more I thought about it, the more insane that sounded. Gee, I needed this alcohol to relax. And what I was doing was I was really, really hurting myself, because I started kind of looking back what I had done the night before and what I had done the night before then, and it was starting to strike me. It was starting to hit me that I was really probably missing out on a lot of life because of this drinking. So right then and there, I decided I was an alcoholic, and I shared with him. I said, I'm not going to drink anymore. I think I'm an alcoholic. And he goes, what? He goes, are you sure you think you're an alcoholic? I go, yeah. He goes, well, I'm going to be going to this meeting. He told me he was going to meet somebody at this meeting that evening later on, and that during that time I could go off on my own. And then he said, I'm going to be going to this meeting. I'm going to be meeting this alcoholic there, because I counsel alcoholics. And so I have to meet this alcoholic because I'm in a lot of trouble. And I said, okay, fine. Do you want to come? And I said, sure. So I went to the meeting, and it was my first AA meeting, and I introduced myself. Oh, no, no, he told me not to introduce myself. He said, don't even introduce yourself as a visitor, because then they'll all think that you're just an alcoholic. You just don't want to admit it. So don't even introduce yourself as a visitor, because you'll have all these people coming up to you after the meeting, and you don't want to deal with those people. So I said, okay. So I didn't do that, and but I knew when I was at that meeting that I felt like I belonged there. I felt like the things I was listening to and hearing I related with. And after that night, I didn't drink again, except that my friend didn't know that. He didn't know it till about, 3 months later when he asked me, we were out to dinner again, he was asking me why I wasn't drinking. And I said, well, I'm an alcoholic. And he goes, you're an alcoholic? He goes, really? Are you sure? And all of this. And I go, yeah. And he goes, why don't you go to AA? And I said, well, because I stopped drinking. You know, that's when he went into the whole thing about, well, it was really a program for living. And it wasn't until, I think, a little bit later that he revealed to me that he was in AA. When I first came to AA, as I mentioned, I didn't really like it. I didn't really identify with it too much because I didn't meet a lot of people my age. And I thought I was probably the youngest person in AA. And I was really kind of disappointed because I didn't relate a lot of the stories because I never really lost too much when I drank, except for my self-esteem and my self-worth and all of those kinds of things. But those things somehow didn't really matter. What mattered was the monetary things, you know, the material things. And as long as I still had material things, I couldn't have lost too much. But I didn't relate to people's stories too much at first. I used to come and pay my dues. I'd come to a meeting a week, and I thought, well, you know, I was doing all right by coming to a meeting a week. And for the first year, that was kind of the way I went until about halfway through my second year, I realized that I better do something about these AA meetings because I wasn't really getting much out of them. And if I was going to really take advantage of them, then I better start maybe listening a little bit more and talking to people and sharing and doing all of those kinds of good things that everybody recommended that you should do. Somehow I always kind of skidded by those things, and I didn't really do a lot of them when I first came in. But then I met some people that were more my age, and I remember meeting John Panetta, and he told me that that I should try this meeting here. And so I came over here, and I checked it out, and I really liked it. And I started meeting more people my age, and I started enjoying AA more. I started really, really listening, and somehow I started identifying more with what people had to say. The more people that I met that were my age, and I started seeing people a lot younger than me in AA for the first time, and I'd never seen that. That kind of shook me a little bit, because I thought, that alcoholism was a disease for old people. Somehow I always associated it with, as being a disease for old people. I don't know why. It's just my experience of meetings. But today, I really enjoy meetings. I look forward to them. I come to them, and I really listen. I get involved, even whoever's speaking. I remember one of the things I learned very early was principles before personalities, and that's always helped me a lot, was principles before personalities, because I didn't really like a lot of people that I heard share, and I had a lot of trouble with that. The principles before personality seemed to make a lot of sense, and as I applied that in other areas of my life where I had problems with people, it helped too. And I started seeing that some of these principles in the program would work in other areas of my life, not just with my disease. And that's when I began to grow. I think I started growing more most in this room here than I ever had before in any of the other meetings, because I really started to identify with people's stories much more. Today I have a pretty good life. I'm good friends with my priest friend that is also in the program, and we're very close, and it was one thing I think that really brought us even closer, because today we can share about how we used to drink, and we can laugh about it, and we can kind of, see how stupid we were and all this kind of stuff. And he's also a psychologist, and he's very good at it. And I remember him telling me, I'd go into his room for counseling, and he told me, well, Bob, you're just going to have to get used to living your life on an emotional, you live your life on an emotional roller coaster. You're always going to be up and down, but just kind of get used to it, because there's nothing, that can be done for you. And this was when I was still drinking. And little did he know, you know, now we just kind of laugh about it because I have, I've had a good taste of a lot of serenity. And I never thought that I would have that. I always thought I would just always be either really depressed or really high or really depressed or really high. And, that I would always live my life that way. And today, things are just fine. You know, I don't get too overly excited anymore, and I don't get depressed anymore. That's something that I always thought, you know, I would always be a depressive person. I was a depressive kind of personality. I always thought I was just a depressed person, and that's why I had to drink to kind of pull myself out of depression. But today, I don't get depressed. It's something that struck me this last couple of years, this last year especially, that, you know, my mood is just pretty much the same all the time. As long as I keep getting to meetings during the week, I get to 3-4 meetings at least during the week, then my mood is fine. I don't have to worry about things. So this last year I had a very big crisis come up in my life that moved me out of the area, so I don't get to this meeting that much anymore. And a lot of things just kind of got shuffled around in my life, and I was able to really kind of go with it because, thank God, I had been able to take care of myself all the way up to when the crisis occurred. So when it happened, you know, I just kind of reacted, you know, appropriately to the situation. I didn't go crazy. I didn't have to drink. I didn't do all kinds of things. I went through a lot of pain, but I had a lot of friends. I had some good people supporting me, and for that, I'll always be eternally grateful. And I owe, you know, I couldn't say in 10 minutes how much I owe to the program for saving my life and for saving other friends of mine's life. I've seen it work in other people's lives, and my people that, especially my good friend that I'm so close to, I just thank God that, you know, we have life to live today. We don't have to get depressed. We don't have to go crazy. Today I'm just very grateful, and very grateful to be here tonight. And with that, I'll close. Thank you.
For the evening, Jackie B. from Sunnyvale.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jackie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
And I feel good today, and I feel good most of the time. It's about all I got used to it. And my life works, and I feel good almost all the time. You know, when I chair a meeting, I chastise myself because I get so serious. You know, I don't know why I should get serious. I'm just talking about life and death. And yours and mine, I get so serious. I'm going to tell you all a joke real quick. That's not for you, that's for me. This guy's an alcoholic, and he's got 40 years of sobriety, and he's got a good program. I mean, he is Mr. AA. He has been to trivia meetings, and it's in his soul, you know. And being a good guy, he donated his body to science. He died in an automobile accident. So they're piecing him up, you know, the eyes go here and there and everywhere, and they pieced him out, all the good parts. And all that got really left is the brain of this guy. So they just drop in a big vat of alcohol, and the brain goes, oh. I wonder, yeah. I wonder. You know, I think I look good. I think I look good. Yeah, I do, don't I? I know it. I do. I look nice. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I weighed 170. I had zip front Levi jeans, a big sweatshirt, and patches all the statement, and that's back when you had your philosophy on your ass, you know. And I had this big mouth with a tongue sticking out that said, "Kiss my ass," you know. And on my first day meeting, and I wore all this stuff, and I thought it was really cool, and I was a very shy person. I don't know about that. All my life until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, just about all of it, except for several years when I was in the service in the Navy as a medic. I was so ill, I was in for several years. I got out and I was still a virgin. Oh, God, I don't know. I made up for that in Alcoholics Anonymous, but then therein lies another story. You know, we're all doing the best we can with what we've got to work with, and it's all good. You just have to trust me that it is all good, irregardless of what it appears. We are all on a spiritual path, and you are headed for sainthood eventually, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. So, most of my life before that, except for that I had been an entertainer, a singer, and impersonations. And I traveled all over the country in and out of the country, and I had a drink to do it. And I can't remember where I've been. I really literally can't. The way it was for me as an entertainer is I get all dressed up, and I had these beautiful gowns on, and they sparkled and they shined, and I always like amber lights. They fill in the holes in your face. And actually, the more light, the better you look. You know, you don't have shadows. Give me more light, more light, you know. And it's beautiful gowns, and it's a real cute little thing, too. And get all dressed up and go out there, and you don't want anybody to look at you. Now, that's a sick person that gets all dressed up, goes out, puts a gown on and a lace cincher, and stands in front of lights, and you don't want anybody to look at you. You're in the wrong business, honey. And that's just, you know, you're a typical alcoholic. My sobriety has, everything is relative, and I don't know about anybody else's insides, and I don't know your heart, although I suspect a lot, but I do know mine, and it was rough. I was, by, I don't know whose standards, by my standards, I was a low-bottom drunk, and that's good. That was good, and I'm grateful for that. I had come to, loss of a husband and children. That part about the husband was good. No, I'm not one of not because he was a bad person either. It's just that it wasn't a good place for either of us. And into the food stamps and the welfare, and we called it low income housing. I went back a couple of years ago, and I had to tell you this, but it was the slums. And that's good too. The hardest part of my sobriety happened for me. So I can't tell everybody's story to help everyone. I can only tell my own. Was after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a very sick person before I ever picked up a drink. And I think of myself as an out-of-control human being. And everything that I know, I've learned here, that I hold dear, that makes my life work, that gives me joy, I had no knowledge that it existed. And if I did, I sure didn't want it. I wanted speed, and took lots of it too. And I wanted the oldest thing, hip, slick, and terminally cool. What I was a totally controlled by fear person who managed it with grandiose bullshit. Now that's hard to do when you're scared and you don't want people looking at you or noticing you. But part of you is out there saying, "Look at me, notice me." You may not love me, but you goddamn better pay attention to me. Coming from a shy person, that takes lots of work. And I had spent a lifetime doing that. And that's okay, too. You know, that's all right, too. So I know today that it's all good. And I mean all. That it's all good. So after the husband left and the kids, and one of my children came back to live with me in this setting, and it was good for her, too, by the way, when I was age 30, it seemed like the shit just hit a fan for this person. Before that, I was going through life. I tell you the God's truth, if anybody can understand this, I don't know where I was. I don't know where I lived. I wasn't present. My memories are poor of much of my life. My own children today have to say, "Mom, remember when we did so-and-so, where we were so-and-so," and this is without alcohol. I just wasn't there, and I... With my limited wisdom today and from the vantage point of today, I see that things that had happened in my past life had never been addressed, shall we say. And somehow or another, at age 30, they screamed to be addressed. And by then, I had become an alcoholic, too. So as I began to try, however faltingly, to get sober, these things that had never been addressed were there also. And my underlying emotional illnesses came full forward. And full to the front of my life. And the form that took was, and this is many times without drinking for many months, I ended up in institutions, and once certified insane in the state institution of Pontiac, Michigan, four-pointed. That means you know, both arms and legs spread eagle, four-pointed. And that's without a drink of alcohol, so you can imagine. What had happened was, this is hard, still hard for me to say because I think I got a little self-pity still going there. You know, I'm not well yet. I'm still working on a lot of things. But my mother killed herself when I was about five, as best I can recall. When I was born, it was unfashionable to be illegitimate. So I was secreted away in a place, some kind of place, and it wasn't a very nice place. And I don't think it was a very bad place. And all I had was my vantage point. It was old people and young people, and I know for a long, long time I couldn't stand to be for the sun to come through windows and hit me in the afternoon, because I vaguely recall that I was in some kind of crib for a long time, and I laid there on myself for a long time, and that I was, you know, alone. And all I recall was some little some black lady who washed our clothes and told us we were dirty. And to this day, I'm crazy about black people. I just love them. Every time I see a black person that's old, an older lady, big bosom, kind of fat, I want to go over and say, "Mama!" I'm crazy about black people. I don't know, it's just a thing. Maybe I was in another life. I just love them so much. Anyway, so I had that. And I vaguely knew these things occurred. I never thought about them. Didn't bother me, you know, and I don't know where I lived, you know. And but when age 30, I began to drink really alcoholically, and I'd lay in my bed, and I began to think and cry, and I started making the rounds of the hospitals, and the sober-up hospitals, and the mental hospitals, because by then I had tics. I was developing tics. And then I had was beginning to get severe, debilitating depressions. And you know, unable to speak, and I get real funny. I go into a depression, and I wouldn't want anybody to notice me or talk to me because I couldn't speak, but I couldn't be alone, but I couldn't be with people either, which is a hell of a dilemma. So I wouldn't want anybody to notice me, so I put on something like a trench coat, a headscarf, and dark glasses with the thing pulled up, looking real weird, hoping nobody'd notice me. Anyway, so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1972, and I went to meetings every week, and I went to 4 and 5 meetings every week. And this is during the period of my life that I wasn't working, when I was doing welfare scene and the insanity scene. And I drank, and I drank about every 6 months or 8 months or 6 weeks. And, you know, I don't have enough wisdom to know what really was going on. I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know if I didn't want to get well. I don't know. You know, that's just the way it was. And I guess the worst it's ever been for me is to have 6 months of sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous and take a drink of alcohol. That is the darkness of the night and the soul that only another alcoholic who has done it can understand. Like, not I'm different, like I'm sicker than or worse than, but I'm different, like I'm evil and believing it. And they told me to go and look in the mirror and say, "I love you." And I looked in the mirror and I said, "I hate you. I will kill you. I will stab you. I'm a sick cookie. And I will stab you. I will hurt you. And I'd like to hit you and kick you and bite you. You know, and that's good. And I mean that. That's good. That's really good. I tell this story because it's my story. Once I was in a mental hospital, they had deemed me sane, and I was going to be released the next day, and back into whatever. And that night before I was going to be released, I got up under my hospital bed in the real low, and I rolled myself up in a ball. You know, I was scared shitless, and I didn't know what of, you know. And I was rocking like a goddamn crazy person that I was. And it always would frighten me that things would come out of my mouth, and I knew I didn't say them. Because, you know, God in me was alive then, and the sane one in me. My God center was at work then. The God that's alive in me today that I had no knowledge of and didn't care to anyway. He was there with me then. And all of these things are good. And things would come out of my mouth, and I didn't think I had said them, but I knew they came from my mouth. And it was very frightening. And what I would say to myself in walking that night, I'd say, "Nobody's coming, nobody's coming, nobody's coming." And I consider that a very deep and abiding and wonderful spiritual experience. Because the truth of that very pitiful scene is that nobody's coming. And that's true for you too, except for God himself. And somewhere, I'm not on a conscious level, but somewhere in a part of me that matters the most on my God level, I knew my fantasies weren't going to come true. The father I never met wasn't coming. I wasn't going to get a bigger welfare check. Some man who loved only obese women who had these big bellies and who shook a lot and who had debilitating depressions, he wasn't going to come and love only me either. And he wasn't coming either. You see, none of this happened for me. Something happened to my real self, my real God in me, way down deep where God lives, where I really lived and didn't know it. Something important happened. And I realized that, you know, if life was ever going to be any different, I was going to have to cooperate a little bit. I was just going to have to cooperate, you know, just a little bit. And nothing, I can't say a big miracle, no, nothing changed overnight. And I know now what I consider probably was, by the way, they always used to want to, I make no judgments on people who take medication prescribed for them by physicians who are familiar with our steps and our principles. I no longer do that. That is not mine to do. And we have some genuine, truly genuine bipolar personalities, or manic depressives, as they're called. And I was heavily medicated for quite some time. But and they always wanted to put me on lithium, but I wouldn't because I heard it made you fat. Anyway, and so I didn't, and so I just came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I, by then I was in the psychiatric system. It's just great. You know, I was in Pontiac State Hospital, and I remember saying one day, you know, I don't ever have to do anything if I stay here. And of course, there's a lot of potatoes, and I'm getting fatter, and my ego can't stand because I used to be cute. And I have to eat these goddamn potatoes, but I don't have to do nothing. If I just stay here, the state of Michigan will take care of me. You know, and the sun shines, and I'm being a typical alcoholic. I was running the place inside of 3 days. All the patients thought I was one of the counselors. You know, that's how we are. You know, that's the truth. You can ask any alcoholic who's ever been in that house. But anyway, I think I was in one of my mood, my manic states, and I didn't even have a year of sobriety. I had 9 months of sobriety, and was feeling real good for me. And I sold all my welfare household and got a U-drive to the Colts Cadillac and put my color TV set in it. And here I came, you lucky Californians. And I love this state. My niece visits me from Ohio, and she had not been here before. She says that God started on the East Coast, and when he got to California, he had it down, you know. He had it down. And I vaguely remember all the places I've been, and she's right. This is glory. This is the land of true beauty. If you're alert like I am today and aware and appreciative, and you can go out in your little backyard and hear the birds and plant your little zinnias. I go insane over zinnias, you know. I'm the greatest zinnias. And this is a state to be in. This is a, God, this warmth and the sun on your back. You do some great meditations with the sun on your back. I guarantee you that. This God thing, I never had any trouble with this God thing. He didn't bother me, and I didn't bother him. And I didn't feel a lot of guilt about it. God gave me enough to bear. I wasn't born Catholic. And I didn't have a lot of religious guilt. I had a lot of well-meaning people who, successions of people who had raised me, who were doing the best they could, too, with what they had to work with, but who generally, I got the impression that I ought to do better, and what I wasn't doing wasn't good enough, and I wasn't right. And if I was feeling good, then I ought to feel guilty, because it wasn't very nice to feel good about yourself. You know, you were out of line. So I cared that to you people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I digress. I was in the psychiatric system and liking that, too. And they would tell me, you're very angry, beat on this pillow. I said, well, I never raised my voice in my life. They said, very angry, beat on this pillow. And one psychiatrist told me to come back next week with nothing on but a trench coat and a lot of interesting things. And then I go to these Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I'd stand up and make woman's lib speeches. And I'd stand on the chairs and cry. And I couldn't quit talking. I couldn't quit talking. I couldn't. because my God, if I kept talking, I'd have to hear myself, you know. And these alcoholics said, we love you. Keep coming back. My God, how powerful that was. You know, either I was so sick, or God only placed weller people around me. In all that self-centeredness, in all that insanity, I cannot recall one person ever coming up to me and saying, you're out of line. Maybe it would help if they'd done it sooner. But no one ever came up to me and said, you're acting weird. Or you're out of line. Why don't you sit down and shut up? Or why don't you do better? Why don't you do different? Or why do you monopolize? Why do you tell these grandiose lies? Why do you demand this attention of us? Why do you act like no one ever said that to me? So I stayed confused. I went to the psychiatrist, and they told me to beat on the pillow. And the alcoholic said, I love you, keep coming back. And I'm only speaking for myself, but I couldn't get sober because I stay confused, you know. I was a great believer, a great worshiper of education, and because they were somebody, and I knew I was nobody. I mean, I really knew I was nobody. And these people had degrees, and I should listen to them. Then I went over here with these former bartenders and under the bridge sleepers and dope addicts and housewives and thieves and criminals and child molesters too, and they said, we love you, keep coming back. But I had all this faith in psychiatry, so I had to do that. And that's good too. I had to do that from 1972 until 1977 when I got sober. And I mean with all my heart that it's all good. When I describe these, you know, what were horrendous scenes, rocking under the hospital bed and saying nobody's coming, how else would I know what somebody's heart feels like when they've been in that situation? When I see psychiatric patients, they love me. They say, I don't know what it is about you, but I can talk to you. And inside I say, no shit. It took me 4 years in Alcoholics Anonymous to get a job. I had three and a half years had a very dear friend. I'd get in these situations, and I'd be doing that at Markham calendars, that I felt bad. I felt really bad. 18, 20, 25 days out of the month. And the reason I didn't drink was, during those times, I don't know, except for the grace of God himself. You know, I had no desire to drink, and I'm telling you, it hurt. And I'd go over to my friend's house, and she knew me by now, and the best psychiatric hospital I had ever been in was under a coffee table. They're named the Winchesters. They've moved since moved. And I'd go to her house with my trench coat and my dark sunglasses, and nobody could touch my body or look at me or notice me or acknowledge that I existed, but I couldn't be alone either. So that's a rough spot. You can't be alone, and you can't, you know, with my 3.5 years of sobriety, and I'd crawl under her coffee table, and I'd rock, and they had this video game, the TV over here, I'm under the coffee table, and they're playing this goddamn video game, and I'm under the coffee table rocking with my 3.5 years of sobriety. Why don't y'all laugh at me? I think that's great. Anyway, and that's good. That's good. That's wonderful. You know, when and God bless my grandmother, she was my central mother figure, I can say that, mother figure, and a good woman, and a wonderful woman. I love her. She's dead today, but she was a human being. And the best way she knew to make you good was to tell you you weren't doing very good, and we all know better than that today. And I love that woman. God, what a woman. What a worker. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, she died when I had about, a little over a year of sobriety. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, in my mind, she'd raise up in the grave every 6 months, look at me and say, why don't you do something with yourself? And I said, I don't know. So I'd go rent a piano. And I was going to teach myself piano, going back in showbiz. And I'd bring that piano home, and I'd look at it and listen to the tape and look at the notes, and I just get so depressed, you know. I don't know, Ollie May, why I'm not doing any better. That's just the best I can do, you know. And then I said, oh, fuck that. And I go to a lot of meetings and run around and talk a lot and talk to everybody. And I think I felt pretty good. I thought I did. I mean, I didn't know any better. I couldn't shut up long enough to find out how I felt, you know. And I worked. I always worked. I had as much as three jobs at a time. But I'd say, well, I can't take a real job because I'm a free spirit. And these people are real, go to work at the same place every day and show up and they're on time. And they put in a good day's work and they get a good day's work for the money and they're there and they're consistent. I can't do that because I choke when I go inside of buildings. When you lock me in a building, I'll choke and I'll suffocate. Well, what I didn't know is that, I couldn't form relationships. I couldn't get that close to people, you know, and I couldn't be that close to them for that long, but I didn't know that. So, I'd been in the service, a medic in the service, and that had been a positive experience for me, and I'd worked as a nurse's aide. So I started about thinking about my grandmother was still raising up about every 6 months and saying, why don't you do something with yourself? And lay night down, and that'd be the end of it. She'd close her cusk, and then I'd go along and go to a lot of meetings, and everybody'd say, I love you, and I'd slow down once in a while, hear a thing or two, didn't get a new sponsor when I came out here, but I talked to a lot of people, and I couldn't quit talking, because I might have to listen, dear God, to my insides. And then she'd raise up and say, why don't you be somebody? And oh my God, I'd get depressed, I'd go rent something else, or sign up for some course, or an art class, and I'd be great for a week. Then I'd get depressed, because I just wasn't fucking up to it, you know. So what I think, you know, I would think things like, well, I know she's dead, but I know she's right. I ought to make something of myself. You know, something big, too. And something important. And people respect me and listen to me. Well, I already know a little about the healthcare biz, same as show biz. And I think I'll do that. And I think I'll do that. So my alcoholic thinking says, well, now, I got to go to college. Well, I know I'm brilliant anyway, just I never had a chance to go to college. That's why I don't have a degree. But I know I'm brilliant. It's just, I may be nuts, but I know I'm brilliant. I could go to college. Well, no sense. I don't want to do that. I might not be up to it. Well, maybe I could because I'm, no sense going to college unless you become a doctor. I say, well, then my mind would say, well, I don't feel up to that. Yeah, I'd do that. If I really wanted to, I know I could be a doctor if I really wanted to. And I say, well, no sense being a doctor. What's the use? Unless I was a specialist, you know. And I'm serious. I have had these thoughts. I mean, I'm not making this up as I go along. And then my mind would say, well, what's the use? No sense being a specialist unless you're a brain surgeon anyway, so what the hell, what's the use? Well, you know, I could do that. I'm smart, shit. Well, you know, there's really no sense in being a brain surgeon unless you can be a world-renowned brain surgeon. So why try? And then I start thinking about it all again. Well, you know, I'm smarter than all these people anyway, so I just hadn't had a chance to show anybody yet. I really could be a world-renowned brain surgeon. I know that. But then I get off on that and I think, oh, fuck you. What if, after I died, somebody was born that was more world-renowned than I am, than I become? Oh, well, what's the use? No sense trying anyway. So what happened to me is important for me. Is I became a nurse, and I'm not a head nurse. I'm a 4-pounder. Sometimes you walk so hard you can't breathe because you smoke and you're running like crazy anyway. And I'm a great nurse, and I'm a big nurse. I'm not a head nurse. I'm just a wonderful lesson. You know, I'm not a brain surgeon. I'm not a world-renowned brain surgeon, and there's no one after me that's going to become a more world-renowned nurse. I'm just a little teeny nurse in one little hospital. Oh, it's a pretty good-sized hospital. In one county, in one state of California, in one America, in one world, in this one time slot in my one little life. You know, I don't have to be a world-renowned brain surgeon afraid somebody is going to be born after me who's going to be a better and more world-renowned brain surgeon than me. That I can just be on one C5, and I can pound the bricks day after day and love and learn, and I learned to, I guess about the most important thing I know for my life and for Alcoholics Anonymous and for my sobriety. And if anybody's wondering why you're born, I'll tell you now. You may not believe me, and that's okay too, because you're going to learn some exciting things while you're finding out for your own self. And what I learned on my job is the most fun I can have, the greatest joy I can have, the highest I can get, the biggest kicks I can get out of life is loving and serving. I'm telling you, you know, alcoholics are not the only people who suffer. When I got plenty of alcoholics where I work in cancer, and alcoholism is a predisposition to a lot of forms of different cancers, or about all cancers. Anyway, and I learned, you know, I don't have to compete, and I don't have to be you, and I don't have to be better than you, and I'm not better than you. And slowly but surely, Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me, and this has been the hardest one, is that I'm not lesser than you either. Do you know what a comfortable, wonderful freedom that I look for in the bottle, freedom that I look for in pills and dope? Do you know what a wonderful thing it is, how free I am just to be me? That means I can get in my Honda, my little red Honda, and drive around, and there I am, just happy as pig and shit, just by a good sense. You know, that means I can be in my kitchen. One of my favorite things to do is bake cookies in the kitchen. A swinger like me, I belong to swappers clubs, honey. Here I am in the kitchen baking cookies, Jesus Christ. And God, I hope my husband knows. Don't ever give him this tape, okay? That I'm safe there, that I'm me there, that I'm happy there. I was working the factories in Detroit for a while. I was living on welfare, and I was making, this is only 1977, I was making $13.72 a day take home, and lifting steel and working at plastics and plastic moldings and things like that. And that was good too. That was really, really a good thing for me to be, and it's a good place to be, and that's the only thing I was suited for. You know, but anyway, I get home from work filthy, absolutely filthy. And in the beginning, I'd be trembling. My muscles were gone, you know, and I'm competitive. And I've got to compete with the men. I've got to lift more steel than the men do. You know, I've got to get out there with my ego and come home dead dog tired and probably smelly and living alone and so bent that I cannot even shower. I cannot change my clothes. I have to get out of the house, and I have to get over to my sponsor's house. Because I cannot be alone by myself that long. I'm not able to be alone by myself. And today, I look like a mouthy person, I'm like I'm a yada, yada, yada. And I am, but to some extent. But I love being alone. I love putzing in the garden. I mean, I'm safe now. I never was safe in my life. Everybody in the entire world was bigger, better, stronger and knew what was going on than me. And I didn't know what was going on. I mean, what's going on? And I didn't have enough whatever to ask the question, even the what's going on. Everybody was bigger and better than me. And the pain of that and the fear of that I covered with alcohol and by performance. Grandiose bullshit. You know, just higher and deeper and more grand. And an excruciating performances. What performers we are. And Alcoholics Anonymous taught me that everybody in this program puts their pantyhose or their pants on the same way. And Alcoholics Anonymous taught me that some people in this program have a lot of wisdom and highly developed spiritual beings and don't know shit about something I know a lot about. And that there's some little guy that's got 30 days of sobriety who's chewing his tongue. And somewhere in him, he's got something that I need to know desperately to make my life work even better. And that nobody's keeping score on me anymore. That only I was keeping score. And the most wonder of wonders, I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that I can't get good enough to love me. And I can't get respectable enough to make you respect me. Because, you know, you can't fool anybody. I learned that here, too. Because what we're talking here is we're talking with our heart. As long as you're talking with your heart, they're listening. You better believe they're listening. And there's nothing wrong with education. There's nothing wrong with it. And I still respect people. My daughter's getting herself educated, and I'm all. I couldn't do the things that she learns. She's just a business major, taking calculus, computer science, quantitative analysis. Jesus. You know, and I'm impressed, you know, with my own baby. And but I learned Alcoholics Anonymous very slowly taught me that I can't get good enough to feel good. Now, I don't know if that's your elk of your insanity, but I can't, my outsides cannot get good enough to make my insides feel good. Now, I can act as if until it becomes the truth. You know, I used to say at meetings, what I'm about to say is a truth, or shortly will be. And it's okay to get up and say what you hope is the truth, and halfway believe it's the truth. That's good. That's real good. Because that's how it gets from here, here, and finally trickles down to here, where your real truth is, where your real truth center is, where your soul or your heart, where you can fool no man or no woman. And you really can't even fool yourself. In order to do that, you have to drink. Yeah. And so it took, I encourage anyone who thinks they've got 3.5, 1 year, 2 year, 4 years, 8 years, 10 years, and you ought to be doing better. Maybe there's an area in your life where your peers can look at that and say, you know, this guy's got 6 years and he's pumping gas. And I'm not giving him a carte blanche not to work his program. And I'm not saying, well, you didn't drink today, so you're a winner. I don't believe that either. I do not believe that. Unless you got under 30 days or 90 days. There's more going on here. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me life. I never had a life before. I lived in an ozone. I don't know where I lived. I don't know where in the fuck I was. Alcoholics Anonymous is life. But I work where I see death. My loved ones die. They stay there long enough for me to love them very much. They're all men. It's the Veterans Hospital, and I love men anyway. God, I love them a lot, you know. And I see death, you know, and death ain't no big deal. And life ain't either, unless it's a good life. You think I want to get sober to be deeply depressed? You think I want to get sober to hang in there, just hang in there the way I lived the first 3.5 years of my sobriety? 3.5 years of sobriety, the incredible pain I was in, and that's okay. That's the best I could do. And that was my learning and my way and God's way and a good way, because I sure know how to feel. I sure know how to feel another person's pain, especially emotional pain. And I sure got a lot to give in that area, because I have a lot of understanding in my heart for my own experience in that area. And I didn't get sober to live like that all of my sober life. And I tell you with all my heart and with all my honesty that I have everything any right-thinking human being could ask for. And when I don't have it, it's because I'm not thinking right. And I praise God and I thank God for this program, because I have enough experience now to know that it works. When I'm not thinking right, I know what to do. This God person, I began to want things. And he wasn't punishing, and he wasn't good, and he wasn't bad, and he wasn't, and maybe even wasn't. I was too scared to deny him completely, but I began to want things. I was a baby. I didn't know any better than to pray for things. That's okay, too. And so I began to pray to this God for things, like a car that worked, or get me to California, or to get me this job, or to help me get through this day and not get so emotionally bent I had to go home. And he began to give me things out here. He's a very wise God. You know, first you got to get the alcoholic's attention. And there's nothing more spiritual and more thrilling to me than to see a newcomer with 6 months of sobriety come in and say, I got a job. And you know what I'm thinking? God loves you. God's getting your attention. God's got to get our attention with things. And then it starts. Then the real healing, the real wellness, the balance, the feeling like you've got rights on this planet, feeling like you're free to go anywhere, feeling like you can face any man or woman in the eye and say, I was an asshole. You know, I fucked up today. I was wrong. You know, I feel like you can look them in the eye and say, no, I will not accept that for myself. These are your limits that you may go with me. Now, that's a miracle to me. For me, this human being, to be able to say to another human being, especially someone who has power over me, to say, no, you may go no further with me. This is my limits. See, because I had such low self-esteem. I had no rights. on this planet. So I began to pray for this, pray through this God, and he began to give me physical things that got my attention. And I said, Jesus Christ, I'll be damned. I ask for things and I get them. I get them. I was just knocked out. You know? And so, being a suspicious Capricorn, I kept track with him too. And I began to look at God's track record. And I do that today. And God's got a good track record with me. He gives me things that I forgot I asked for. In a moment of deep spiritualness and feeling real close to God, I'll ask for a deeper letting go of my ego, and then I'll forget all about it, you know. And 6 months later, he's put me in a position to be able to do that. And there's a lot I don't know now, and that's not an attempt at a humility. But God has proven to me over and over and over in you, in my life, in my children's life, especially looking at you, you know, the deep illness I've seen people come back from, them, people who were nothing but a piece of shit before they took a drink. They couldn't do life. I'm talking about myself, as always. We're always talking about ourselves. And I've seen these miracles over and over and over and over. It's incredible. It's incredible. God's track record is incredible. And so I begin to believe. And I noticed something. I noticed that when I had faith in God, that I didn't hurt, that I was free, that people didn't frighten me, that I could go places I couldn't go before. I noticed that when I believed in this God, that I was safe for myself, that I was a different person, that the things came out of my mouth that I did say, but I don't know where they came from, and they were wise and good things and gentle things and kind things. And I noticed that when I that this felt good. So I began to ask this God, increase my faith, because I don't want to hurt anymore. I want to be safe in my kitchen. I want to be unafraid in my Honda. I want to be unafraid in the checkout line at Long's Drugstore, because that's what I was. I was afraid. I was one big ball of fear. And that illness took many forms. And that separation took many, many forms for me. And it's slow, and it takes time. You're going nowhere anyway, and neither am I. Praise God, hopefully you're not going anywhere anyway. And the worst thing that happened to you, the best thing you can do for it is say, thank you, God. Thank you, God. Give me more. I praise you for it. Thank you, God. And that's my heartfelt experience. That is my experience with this God that I'm beginning to understand. And I found out all these reversities in here, that when I begin to fake it or half feel it, when I begin to act like a decent human being, when I begin to have the desire to be a little bit nicer, when I begin to genuinely have the desire to be showing up on time, or look kinder, or take time to listen to you, or quit thinking about myself so much, and truly tune in and listen to you, when I begin to, these things begin to happen, and I begin to gentle out and smooth out. And you know what happened? That's what God became. That's what God became. So then I knew that God and I were one, that I am you. I am you. And you are me, whether you understand that or not. You don't have to, and I don't care. It's my story. And that I am you. There's no separation. My ego, you know, my ego can sometimes tell me I'm different. I trust God today, you know. I don't have to lean so heavily on human beings to tell me I'm okay. I don't have to lean so heavily on human beings to tell me I'm not going to die, to tell me to soothe me. I can go this. I trust him. I really trust him. And the one most important thing I would leave you with is all these wonderful things, these before and after pictures that I have presented to you here. None of it happened. None of it happened for me until I put down alcohol. And though I may not have spoke of it that much, the act of putting alcohol to your lips, I am an alcoholic. I have crawled on my hands and knees through what's called Wrigley's, but they're called Safeway, through a Safeway in a Long's parking lot on a Sunday morning, not drunk, not in the least bit drunk, just sick son of a bitch. Sick as a goddamn dog. The way only an alcoholic knows your legs go. Your muscles go needing to drink so bad. And this pretty shiny little lady here is crawled on her hands and knees on a Sunday morning to get some wine across those two parking lots. You know. And all these good things and the balance and the peace and the trust that I love you, I trust you, you're not out to get me. You're not going to hurt me. I thought you were going to hurt me. I wasn't safe anywhere. I wasn't safe in my mind. I wasn't safe no matter where I was. I wasn't safe, and I was frightened. And none of this good things, none of this safety came to me until I put down alcohol. And maybe you're more advanced than I am. And maybe you're more able to listen than I was. And that's good. That's what you're supposed to be, you know. And you're on God's, truly, you're on God's timetable and not mine. And I began to realize that more and more the longer I'm here. But nothing happened. Nothing happened until I stopped drinking alcohol. Nothing happens. And I don't get a damn if you go to 7 meetings a week and drink a thimble full on the 7th month at the end of the month. You are not going to get any of the gifts or the blessings or the sanity or the peace or the jobs or the relationships or chance at the relationships or the love or the respect that we need and like. And I like it. None of it. It is not coming until you put down the alcohol. And I don't give a damn what you have to go through not to pick up that drink. I don't care. You can call your sponsor. But I'm not lying. If I'm lying, I'm dying. And that's the truth, you know. I am dying if I'm lying. Or I'm well on my way to my own death and close to a drink of alcohol. If I'm lying to you, nothing happens. Absolutely nothing. And it doesn't matter what you have to do not to take a drink. And God was merciful with me. He just zapped me. And I was in a living hell on earth, and I didn't drink, and I don't know why. And looking back up with all the wisdom that I have now, I don't know why I drink, except that I had a good God. And I'm grateful for all my experiences. There's something going on here that's beyond my limited knowing, you know, but little by little it is revealed to me. Some big doings going on here. We're all talking to my friend before the meeting. We're all headed in the same direction, whether you realize it or not. You are headed for sainthood. And there's nothing you can do now to stop it. Absolutely nothing. Even if you drink alcohol, there's nothing you can do. It's out of your hands. And you can go at your pace or you can go at God's pace. And you have the pain, that's good. And you kill the SOB that wants to stop your pain. You have your pain. Because, honey, you can't stop doing what you're doing. It's hurting yourself till the pain level gets high enough. So get in it, wallow in it, rub it all over you, whatever you got to do. It's all right. It ain't going to kill you. The only thing that's going to kill you is drinking alcohol. I have a good life. My life works. I had a bad day yesterday. And I didn't know how to act because I'm not used to it. And that's the God's truth. I'm just not used to it. And I do my footwork. And without my consciously being aware that God's in charge and that He loves me and that He has my interest in His heart and that He is working in my life and that He's right beside me whether I feel Him or not, without my conscious awareness of that, I am totally back four-pointed in Pontiac State Hospital whether I take a drink or not. I need this, God, to keep me sane and well and balanced and functioning and productive. I like to be productive. I'm proud of that because I was on welfare for a long time. And I'm productive. I am putting a good day's work almost every time. Not every day, but almost every time. And that means I got a good chance here. And I don't know anything about anything. I know that just a couple. That love is the answer, and I don't care what the question is. I don't care what the question is. That love is the answer. And that God is love. And that's milky, but I know it because I've seen it here over and over. And then I thank you all. I have a good life. Good life. And I got so damn serious again. I'm really a very filthy person. You should hear some filthy jokes these patients and I tell all the time. Dear God, if my husband knew he'd make me quit work. Oh, my God, yeah. I love to laugh, and I laugh a lot. And it's not an insane cackle either. It's from my heart and from my belly. And I haven't told you very much because I don't know a lot. I just told you who I am and that I feel good today, that my life works if I so choose it to work my program, and that I was a piece of ill person and out of control, deeply ill, and I came to you people, and God working through Alcoholics Anonymous did for me which I could not do for myself, which was nothing. And for that, I'm very grateful. Thanks.